fighting for truth, justice, and the American way. Without the cape, we're the superpowers, not even a sidekick. Heck, we don't even have fancy gadgets. This is just Joe and his trusty microphone, made in the USA. This is the regular Joe Show. Oh, so good.
Hello there. Welcome to one. Welcome to all. Joe Giganti, your regular Joe, here with you with this, your VIP backstage soundcheck podcast exclusive to the wonderful, the awesome, the truly most splendiferous listeners. You, the merry band of regulars, joining me each and every day. And I do appreciate it with this bonus track. I mean, you remember the old records? You had bonus tracks. That's what this podcast is. Additional information just for you. Today, joining me, a great American constitutionalist, former member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, soon to be a future and new renewed member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We will be talking to Justice Daniel Kelly in mere moments. Some questions, learn about him. You don't know? If you're in the state of Wisconsin, you should know there is a primary coming up in February. I mean, just as an aside, I hate the spring election concept. I don't know why they don't just do these all in November. I think it's because it would be too easy. If you, politics is the masterful nature to take simple and make it complicated. But I may even talk to the justice about this. But the primary is in February. The general will be in April. And in August, we will have a new Supreme Court justice in the state of Wisconsin. Now, these races are going on all over the country. So if you're not in Wisconsin, the pertinence of this for you is the simple fact that you need to know who these people are because they make very important decisions. In the state of Wisconsin, you have four people running, two whack jobs, proudly, I mean, it's not even a subjective thing, proudly left-wing progressives that are essentially vowing to be just that. If they are elected, so that should be kind of warning enough. And then the other person running in addition to Justice Kelly is Jennifer Darrow, who we will be talking to next week. She is best known because she was the judge that presided over Daryl Brooks's trial, he being the one that undertook the massacre during the Christmas parade two Christmases ago now, killing six, injuring dozens of people, a terrible situation. But we'll get to that next week. Today, sitting with me here in the studio, the great Daniel Kelly. Good day to you, sir. Welcome back. Appreciate you joining me here for the podcast.
Well, good day to you too, Joe. It is so good to be on your show again with you and to be in your studio. This is the first time I've had an opportunity to come and hang out with you.
That's right. It's so funny, because in radio, it's kind of like modern communication. You know, you say, I talk to somebody, 90% of the time, You were texting with
him. Yes,
but it's just, it's what we say. We're just like, oh, yeah, I just talked to him yesterday. And then I'm like, my kids laugh at me because I'll be like, well, okay, I texted with him. And they're like, Dad, doesn't make a difference. I'm like, it does to me because there's this neat art of talking. It's kind of like letter writing. But yes, so good to have you in person. I didn't even think about that.
And I got to tell you, you know, your intro says you don't even have any cool gadgets. I mean, this is not quite Fred Flintstones here.
No. Well, and we were talking just before we began recording. I mean, these studios, I mean, compared to where I started in radio, long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, but these are very, very good studios. I mean, I always tell this that when I launched a radio network in 2007, 2008, that's what I actually came to Wisconsin for. And I remember having a young producer come to my office telling me he needed two more master computers in his production control room for the show. And it was a music show. I mean, in talk radio, we have a lot of things because we have sound bites and all this. Mm-hmm. And I listened patiently. I said, you have more computing power in that studio than it took to put a man on the moon and get him back again.
That's right.
I told him, I said, you know, when I was in radio, 7 to midnight on an oldie show, so we had the average length of a song is 2.5 minutes. It was an all-request show, so you'd take the call while a song was playing, record it on a reel-to-reel machine, which I had then explained to him what a reel-to-reel machine was, kids. Mm-hmm. And I said, then to get him ready to play the caller back, because you didn't take the calls live because you get all kinds of problems. But then, you know, it may not be a perfect call. So you didn't just record it, but with a straight razor, you're sitting there rocking the reels back and forth, making the quick cuts, all during a 2.5 minute song, so that you can have the next one, and then you got to cue the song up, roll it in, which, I mean, I'm not complaining. I loved it. Radio is one of the few legal addictions. You get into radio, it's very hard to get away from it. But I just look back. I mean, the first time we had a digital editing program, which eliminated the need for reel-to-reel, and I'm like, how does this work? This can't possibly be as good. And then I'm like, wait, when you make a mistake, you hit Control-Z, and it's the mistake is gone?
Away? Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, the big thing, and I just saw the movie The Fabelmans, which is the story of Steven Spielberg, and it shows him as a young kid editing, and this is true for film and audio back then. You'd cut the slices of your tape, and you'd lay them out in the row of how you're going to assemble them. Most of the time, you'd put a little piece of tape on them because the minute someone opens the door, they blow away, and you got to try to put them back. Anyway, nobody cares. I mean, the technology is amazing. What we can do.
It is. And you know, and I'll tell you what: the lobster lunch you provided, that doesn't hurt either.
Well, I mean, we like to have that, a little bit of steak tips. I mean, just want to. It's all about protein, right? We got to keep. Yeah. There's no lobster dinners right now. That sounds more like what happens in Washington. But now, so you are a former member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I mean, we had you on the show back when I was still doing Saturdays. We had you when you were running for Supreme Court. Unfortunately, that didn't work as we had all hoped it would in that circumstance. But before we get into this race and everything else, people have heard your name. You've been on a number of times, not just running for office. You're one of our big advisors when it comes to legal situations. And God knows there's a lot of those nowadays. It seems like everything is a legal situation at this point. Who is Daniel Kelly? I mean, you obviously have not spent your entire life in public service in the government. You've done other things. Tell people the kind of things you've been up to, including what you've been doing since the last time you served on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so thanks for that. So my time on the Supreme Court was really kind of a capstone of my entire career up to that. So I've spent most of my life in commercial litigation. One of the oldest and most respected law firms in the state of Wisconsin, and it was a pleasure to litigate with some really bright folks.
And now, you say commercial litigate. For those that are not as familiar with legal, what does that mean, commercial litigation?
Yeah, so that's when there's litigation involving commerce in one sense or another, trade, sales, construction, anything that has an impact on the economy. That's pretty much falls within the really broad field of commercial litigation.
And I would imagine in that would give you a lot of insight, particularly if you're representing some of these companies, kind of the inner, you speak of commerce. I mean, one of the things we talk about, whether it's someone running for justice or people running for political office, a disconnect from understanding what it is to run a business, to be in business, the challenges they face. I'd imagine that gave you a lot of insight Because, I mean, you're kind of in the down and dirty right there. You're getting involved where there's the problem has been, it hasn't been able to be resolved. Now you're stepping in from a legal point of view. I imagine there's a lot that would tell you about those very inner workings.
There sure is. One of your responsibilities, if you're going to be an effective litigator, you have to understand deeply everything about the subject over which you're litigating. And that often includes getting to know intimately the business that you're representing or the business that you are operating against. And you have to drill down deeply and have a comprehensive understanding of how it functions, because that's the only way you can be effective in the courtroom is to have that level of knowledge. And that's, you know, it really translates over to what you do on the Supreme Court, because every case that comes before us, you know, we deal with every conceivable area of the law that there is on the court. And your responsibility as a justice is to become a subject matter expert in that area. And so you have to drill far, you have to drill deep, you have to drill precisely to make sure that you have a comprehensive understanding of the issues that come before the court for resolution. Because one of the first things we want to do, it's kind of similar actually to the oath you take in the medical profession. First, do no harm. Right?
Unfortunately, a lot of doctors seem to have forgotten that part. But anyway, that's a different topic for a different time.
Let's call it an aspiration.
Yes.
But we really have to take that seriously on the court, because if we draft a sentence that is not sufficiently precise, the lower courts or practitioners might pick up on that and they say, aha, I see a fundamental shift in jurisprudence coming from the Supreme Court based on this sentence or a couple of sentences. And so every word that we write has to be precise. In order to have that kind of precision, you got to know your stuff cold. And the best preparation for that really is a long history of litigation where you get into that habit of academic, intellectual, and practical precision in the work that you do in the court.
Now, I wanted to that point. Recently, there was this Wisconsin, and again, I running for the Supreme Court. Not going to ask specifically about cases. I know that there's a level of distance that has to be kept there. But there was a case, if I recall, this was on. I know it was election related. I want to say it was the drop boxes, if I'm not mistaken, where that was exactly what the Supreme Court, because again, courts don't make policy. They don't legislate. Well, at least they're not supposed to. They're not supposed to legislate. Yeah. And depending on the court, depending on the judge or justice, maybe you get a little bit of a different. But it was over the question of what did the law say? And this has been interesting debate I've had with some elected officials now that the decision. And ultimately, the court came down and said, look, this law has always, I'm paired, not the actual words, but this law, and it goes to precision of language, it makes it illegal. You cannot do what was being done. And one of the debates I got into, and again, not being a lawyer or a justice, but someone that stays at Holiday Inn, so I can, you know, but I can read. I mean, I can read, and I know how to go through logic chains. The decision never said, well, that's illegal from here on out. The job, because that would then you're legislating.
That's right. The job
was to say, what does the law state?
Yeah.
And if the law states that this is illegal, that means it was illegal from the moment that became law. Whatever year they passed that, let's just, for the sake of argument, say it's 2015. I think it was a little bit late. I think it was like 2016, the particular law. But let's just say it's 2015. The job in the case of the court, because the debate I got was, they said, well, the court didn't say when. I said, they don't have to, because their job is to simply say, this is what the law said. And they said the law states this is illegal. Well, if the law's been there since 2015, that means it's been illegal since 20. Doesn't matter if you let it happen. That, again, this is the world of objective, right?
That's right.
So that's the kind of thing we're talking about, though.
It's exactly right. So I think the best way of looking at this is, you know, we have this this thing called separation of powers in our constitutional system. So the people of Wisconsin have told the branches of government what they're responsible for. So the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches each have different responsibilities. And I think that what you're getting at is a great way of understanding that easily in that separation, what's assigned to each of the powers, is to look at the timeline, right? So, you know, this question about was this lawful or before, and did the Supreme Court change it, or is it unlawful from this point forward? Let's map out the branches on a temporal line. So we look at the legislative branch, the first branch of government, and their responsibility is to look into the future and decide what the laws will be starting today and going into the indefinite future. And their responsibility is to figure out what laws will contribute to human flourishing from this point forward, right? So they get the future part of the timeline. The executive gets the present. The executive's job is to take the work that the legislature did and then implement that today and every tomorrow as that becomes today. So the executive gets the present. The court gets the past and the past only. So everything the court does is addressing things that have already occurred. There's been a law that's been broken. There's a contract that's breached. There's someone injured. There's an administrative agency action. Whatever it is, it's always something that's occurred in the past. And what we do on the court is we say, well, what was the law at that time? And what does that say about that circumstance? And so we're always looking at what the law was. We never say, oh, today, this is going to be the law going forward, because that's the legislature's prerogative, right? We only look to the past. And so if you ever hear a member of the court say, oh, we made some good law today, well, that's a good clue that they're not acting as a judge. They're acting as a legislator.
Well, this you hinted at this. I want to talk about that, the separate, you know, the equal but separate branches of government. Mm-hmm. But a moment ago, you made and I used the word flourish, and I think you said to what makes society flourish.
Yeah,
I believe
human flourishing,
which is an amazing insight. In a very one of the things I've always said I enjoy about you is you can take complicated legal matters, boil them down in a way that people can understand in relatively simple terms. And in that statement, I think that you encapsulate what government of all ever is supposed to be,
yeah,
and is forgotten. It's because, you know, we look at it, there's so many, and again, I'm not asking your opinion, my opinion, but, you know, whether it's oppressive, regressive income taxes, you look at what happened with COVID where, you know, stay in your home or we're going to punish you. Yeah. It has become this very punitive instrument that seeks to work against the people, in my opinion, which you just encapsulated beautifully, forgetting that the idea is that the existence of government is supposed to be limited to enabling and supporting and encouraging the flourish.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
to get out of the way.
Yeah.
And that's a lost art.
It is. And, you know, I encourage everyone who exercises governmental authority to go back and read our Constitution, because this is where I get that from. You know, Article 1, Section 1, the very first provision of our state constitution, says that we are all born equally free and independent, and that we have certain inherent rights, that amongst these are life and liberty and the right to the pursuit of happiness, and that governments are instituted for the purpose of protecting those rights, gaining their just powers from the consent of the governed. And so this is what it means. It's part of what it means to promote human flourishing, is to understand that the government's responsibility is to do those things, protect the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if they do that, if they can concentrate on that, we'll be in great shape. But, you know, I think that everybody in state government ought to be looking at that first provision of our Constitution and take that as their watchword with everything that they do in their authority.
Well, again, you used a part of it in your quoting of our magnificent Constitution, the consent of the governed.
Yeah.
That's an important, again, people toss the right, they stop. I mean, with Joe Biden, he can't remember the pursuit, you know, life, liberty, and all that. God help us. But either way, but that's an important, even for the President of the United States, Supreme Court justices, U.S. representatives, senators, state representatives, the consent of the governed.
Yeah.
This is, again, a lost part of this idea that we're a republic, first of all. You know, yes, a democratic form of government, you know, democratic republic, we have representative government. But as a republic, we the people are the sovereigns.
Yeah.
This is why George Washington said, I don't want it. I won't be your king. That's not what we need.
Yeah.
That's not what we just fought this really bloody war to get away from kings, because this is what happens.
That's right.
When you do that, you have to invest the power in the people themselves, because that's who you serve and that's whose consent by which you serve. And again, I think this has become a paradigm that needs to shift back where we have, which, you know, to your credit as somebody that wants to sit on this high court, we need people that understand this, that don't think that they sit, you know, I mean, physically speaking, in most chambers, you know, the judge sits higher and above people for a number of reasons. But in the reality, again, it's a servant job.
Yeah.
You're there to understand what's going on and to answer the question of what does the law say? You know, how does the law, what is the state constitution, where applicable, where does the federal constitution come down on this question, and what's the right solution to it?
That's right. And this is one of the key insights that led to the formation of our constitutional form of government. This idea of who does the authority ultimately belong to? So, you know, there was a couple decades after our American Revolution, there was another. It was the French Revolution.
Ooh, and, the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
Talk about statements in, you know, the opposite is true.
Well, go ahead, all right. So let's take a look. So those two revolutions are oftentimes compared, but they went in dramatically different directions because of where they started from. So in our revolution, it's encapsulated in our Declaration of Independence, the operative part of which we incorporated into the very first article in section of our Constitution, right? So so almost word for word about where the authority comes from, the consent of the government. And the great insight there was that all of the authority to create and maintain governments belongs to the people. And they simply loan their authority to those in government. And that loan is mediated through the Constitution. The French Revolution, completely different. All the authority to create and maintain governments rests in the government. And the government will tell you what your liberties are. And they may grant you some, they might take them back from time to time, but it all starts and ends with the government. And those are two fundamentally different ways of looking at societal organization and where governments get their authority from. So here, we say, government, you don't get to do anything unless we consent to it, the consent of the governed. And in other forms of government, the government says, you don't get to do anything unless we tell you. We, the government, tell you.
Well, I think another pertinent piece of that with the French Revolution, I mean, France at one time was a deeply faithful country rooted in Christian tradition. And with the so-called Enlightenment, I always joke, you know, I always say, like, when you, whether you want to call it socialism or communism or just progressive liberalism, usually they do doublespeak, right? So they talk about smart cars. There's nothing smart about these cars. They're death traps on wheels. You know, I mean, they talk about smart growth. If you've ever, I mean, in your litigation, you may have come across this. Smart growth is anything but. It's all about controlling. People can't have home, you know, independent single-family homes with land, right? Smart growth is all about adopting a European style of, you know, live in the most sparse possible way, kind of the antithesis of America. In the American Revolution, I mean, it's right, again, it's right in the founding documents. I mean, where do our unalienable rights come from? They state it clearly from God.
Yeah.
So in our revolution, and in our founding of our country, we fully embrace those Judeo-Christian values that we believed were what delivered us. I mean, remember, we took on the most advanced military of its time, and we beat them.
Yep.
That was no small task.
Yep.
And there's any number of, I mean, you read the founding fathers, you can see the faith that, you know, that many of them had. Whereas with the French Revolution, not only did you have the vestment of power into the government, but as a part of that, the secularization of society. It decentralized itself. It detached, decoupled itself from that longstanding Christian faith that had helped. I mean, at one time, I mean, people, France, we joke about France, right? Yeah, you know, what's the French, you know, military salute, you know, both hands above your head. I mean, it's all these, they're the butt of a lot of jokes. But that wasn't always the case. I mean, France at one time was a leading power in the world, but that decline began with that secularization, with that idea that the government knows best. Which we had Daddy Knows Best on our television. We never embraced that concept. Thank God we never embraced that concept.
Yeah, and that's I think that's a great insight. You know, take a look at what was happening at the same time that the French were having their revolution. The same time that they were renouncing God. At that same time, we were adopting the First Amendment, and where we find that we are going to constitutionally protect
freedom of speech,
freedom of religion, and preventing the establishment of religion. And so while France was driving out God, the United States was protecting individuals' rights to worship according to the dictates of their conscience.
And think how short of a time that was after they had just helped us.
Yep.
And I mean, that's the other part of it. I mean, they actually helped us when nobody else would. And it was invaluable, much of what, I mean, but at the same time, history is replete with this. When you abandon the source of truth, everything starts to unravel. Now, so bring it to a little more modern. By the way, my oxymoron thing is just that they called it the Enlightenment, and it was kind of anything. But now, as we see, you talked about the First Amendment. This is when, again, I know cases, not going to ask any specific case, I don't know of any right now that are approaching, I don't think I do, of that would be approaching the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But one thing we have seen, whether it's in the Twitter files that are being dumped by Elon Musk, all this, just really so much that's come out, particularly, you know, if the silver lining could be found in all that went on with COVID, it is that so many people are awake, not woke, but awake to what's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it being exposed where, I mean, I refer to it as the Bureau of Approved Thought. I mean, they actually had at one point, they introduced the Disinformation Governance Board, which should scare anyone that's read 1984, that should put a chill down your spine that the United States government's introducing this thing. But I mean, it really is a direct attempt to abridge free speech. And it's, you know, and as you said, it's freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And I want to go to the establishment part because this is one of the big debates where it says that there's nothing that will hinder the practice of it and that it won't be an establishment. Now, in your understanding of the Constitution, is that saying that the government has no, can't talk about religion, can't be, or are they simply saying the government cannot dictate what religion people, I mean, because remember, we broke away from England, which had the Church of England. It's why we had the people that came over originally, because they wanted to get out from under the rule that they had to adhere to a specific Christian faith.
Yeah, so let's take a look at this in kind of general terms. And when the First Amendment was adopted, it was common across the world for there to be established religions, established by governments.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the United States at the time, there were states that had established religions. And so the First Amendment was designed to address the circumstance where people in the individual states, you know, because let me just take a step back. There was some concern by those in different states that if they signed on to this new constitution, that they would lose control of their own state government and that the federal government would just eat everything. And so
Which is a valid concern. Anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, so for a number of the states, they said, look, before we agree to this, we want a declaration of rights. We want a compendium of things to make sure that you, the federal government, know you can't do anything in these areas. And so one of the things they were most concerned about was what happens if the federal government establishes a religion and then that would interfere with the individual's right to worship according to the dictates of their own conscience. And so the impetus for that was we want to make sure the federal government isn't going to establish a religion. There wasn't any sense of, and oh, by the way, you cannot mention the name of God.
Right.
It was, we just don't want an establishment. Right. We don't want there to be an official church of the United States of America. Now, the way that works out in practice, there are a lot of nooks and crannies in that, and that gets fleshed out as cases come before the court, and we look at levels of coercion and all that sort of thing that might that might have the hallmarks of an established church. And so we look for those steps that might lead to an actual established church, and we draw the line and we say you can't do that. So now how that works out in individual cases, of course, we judge those independently as they come. But those are kind of the outline historically of what the concern was at the time and what that amendment was designed to get at.
No, and there's nothing in that either. I'm not trying to put words. I'm asking if you agree that it never said that the government can't interact with religion. The Supreme Court of the United States has the Ten Commandments inscribed on the wall of the Supreme Court. That's again not by accident. Not establishing, but again, it was not that we had to deny that faith or the values that are infused in our Constitution, yet you have so many of these groups that try to pretend that this... It's kind of like when they see in the Second Amendment, which is the next one I get to, where, you know, Joe Biden just the other day said, well, who needs a high-capacity clip? There's no deers wearing Kevlar. What do you need that gun for? And funny enough, I mean, I've read the Constitution many times. I have a copy I carry with me. It's here at the show with me. I've had this particular copy for almost 20 years. You got one in your pocket. I've got one that was given to me by a broadcast, real nice hardbound version of it. I don't read anything about deer hunting or anything else. I see a right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah. So this is one of the most important aspects of being a constitutional conservative jurist. Is you look at the text of the document. You don't read into it things that you want to find there.
No living and breathing.
No living and breathing. You don't ignore things that are there, and you don't try to change it, right? So the job is pretty straightforward. In practice, it can there are complex legal questions we run into. But the approach that we take has to be very straightforward and simple, and it is this. We look for the original public meaning of the text of the Constitution. Because you know what? As it turns out, when that was adopted, it meant something, right? And so it wasn't, the drafters didn't adopt a compendium of words and toss it out on the water and say, this eventually will mean something. We don't know what it might
right.
be. But in the fullness of time, this will have an intelligible meaning. It wasn't that. They drafted it very carefully, and they said, we've got an idea that we're trying to convey to those who are responsible for adopting or rejecting this document. And so it had a fixed meaning at the time it was written. And our job as jurists is to figure out what was that fixed meaning at the time it was written, and then faithfully use that to decide cases. And as it turns out, Joe, you can change constitutions. Now, I see in the constitutions where it has provisions that say how you do it. And I've looked at them real carefully, and I don't see anywhere in there that it says that the court has anything to do with changing the Constitution. And so we entrust that is a right and authority reserved by the people of Wisconsin. And they put in their constitution how it's going to be done. Now, it can be, you know, the process is different between the state and federal governments. But in each case, the people have to approve of any changes. It's not the courts. The courts have to stay out of that. The court's responsibility is to say, we see what you've done, people of Wisconsin, and we will faithfully use that to decide your cases until you choose to change it.
Well, and this gets into how we avoid what is referred to as judicial activism.
Yes.
It's not about your opinion. It's not
That's
about
right.
your feeling. It's about what's there. Now, I do, by the way, I was pulling, I had to get it. You can see as, you know, there's literally dog ears. There's highlighted pages.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's good.
I go, you know, because it is stunning to me, just as a quick aside, and I'm sure in your travels you've seen this, it is stunning how many Americans you meet that have never read, and it's not.
It's not long.
It's not a long. I mean, yeah. This is as you can. I mean, this is a very pretty version of it. This has got. There's an appendix at the end. This has the Declaration with it. It's actually the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Articles of Confederation all in one place, but it's 66 pages.
Yeah. I mean, and you have to add the other material to at least make it look like a book.
Well, right, exactly, because it's a pocketbook otherwise. I mean, that's the beauty of it. I mean, to your point about they had something in mind, they were not reckless in their you talk about precision of language. And one of the again, something else that I think to your point is it says in the Constitution, it's very clear that if we aren't talking about it here, then it's to the states to decide.
That's right.
Which goes to the states. This was not, and this is again not for this race, but just the overview of the world right now. I always hear people that make it sound like we should have the Republicans and Democrats holding hands, singing Kumbaya, and even if there's infighting within the Democrats or the Republicans, oh, this is terrible. And I'm like, have you guys ever read history? I mean, you go to when they were trying to create this document, trying to get this document ratified, there were some pretty heated debates. But in the Socratic way, I mean, this is how they got to this precision. You had the states going, no, look, if you want us to sign on to this, we need some certain, you know, there's got to be some teeth here. There's got to be, that's why you have a statement that says, look, if it's not here, it's a state's right.
That's right.
There's no reading into this. If it's not here, it's not missing.
Yeah.
We didn't put it here. We don't want it here. We want it to be handled there. And again, this is a fundamental understanding of each role and one that I think you very capably explain why, as a Supreme Court justice, this you know your role.
Yeah, I do. And it's because the people of Wisconsin have taught me well. They wrote it very simply so we could all understand it. You know, and I look at it in our, you know, in the United States Constitution, the branches of government are described by Articles 1, 2, and 3. In the state constitution, it's Articles 4, 5, and 7. 7 is the judiciary. It brings up the tag end for good reason, because as the framers wrote 235 years ago, the court is to be the least dangerous branch of government. And the reason for that is because of the authority that the people have entrusted to the judiciary. It's really simple. They said, we've got one thing we want you to do, just one thing. We want you to do it well,
and
but it's
focus
just
on it.
Focus on this, please. Decide our cases according to the law as it exists. Don't concern yourself with the wisdom of the law. We got a different branch for that. We call it the legislature. And if we want different laws, we'll let them know. In the meantime, just do this one thing for us, please. It's decide our cases according to the law.
I'm laughing because we both have 5 children.
Yep.
And I'm laughing because I've had this conversation where there's something hectic going on, whatever, you know, whether packing the car to get on the road or even more of a emergency type situation. And that's one of my now teenage boys to do this. And I have one particular, and God bless him, he's a smart kid. He's very Socratic to the point of pain sometimes because he always wants to ask questions. And I've said to him, I gave you one thing to do. Yeah. Just go do, let me handle the thinking here. Just you know. But he's like, well, what about, and I'm like, no, just this is all you got to do. Or even when interacting with legislators, the work I do, I always say, this is what you do, right? This is you're supposed, because they'll come back at you and be like, well, what about, you know, and I'm like, look, I don't want you to flip fries. This is what you're supposed to be doing. You're in the legislature, you're supposed to be writing the laws, repealing if there's bad laws.
Yeah.
Again, the judiciary, and that's, so to that point, now, work you've been doing after your last stint with the state Supreme Court, you were with the Institute for Reforming Government.
That's right.
Which, I mean, just that name alone is kind of very musical to my ears when I, you know, I of course, I'm old school, you know, I think the fewer government agencies, the better. I could name a few federal ones off the top of my head that we'd be much better without. I have a T-shirt just to get for those new to the show. It says alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Sounds like the name of a good convenience store, not a government agency. So, you know, just my view of the world. But you've worked there. And one of the we've had a lot of issues that have come before the courts at every level, all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States regarding elections. In the state of Wisconsin, there was a lot of confusion, a little bit of the chicken with the head cut off kind of thing, where you had a lot of legislators running around going, we can't do anything. We don't know what to do. You tried to help solve that in the private world, working for IRG. People say, where's the minute? You literally We're trying to write the manual to help them understand their role, because unfortunately, right. it became pretty clear they didn't.
Yeah. So here's a thing that I've seen for a long time, and I was really pleased to have an opportunity to address this. So legislators, their job is to make the law, repeal the law, amend the law, as circumstances warrant. But that's not where their responsibility ends. They're not just supposed to cast their bread on the water and walk away. It is a continuing responsibility for legislators to make sure that the laws that they adopt are accomplishing the things that they meant to accomplish. And so they're supposed to cast their laws out on the water and then watch and see, is this getting the job done, or did we miss the mark? And if we missed the mark, maybe we need to change the law. Or maybe the law is addressing something that is a temporary circumstance, and now it's accomplished its goal, and we can repeal that law. And so their responsibility would be then to address the repeal of the law. And so collectively, that authority and responsibility is known as oversight. So you pass the law, and then you exercise oversight over the executive branch and the way that it is executed. And so so the legislature has an immense amount of authority to keep tabs on the way the law is being implemented. And so,
which only makes sense.
It only makes sense.
Because otherwise, who does it?
Right, exactly. And they have to have this information because they are supposed to be the best informed branch of government. Because, again, it goes back to they have the future part of the timeline. So they got to peer into the murky future and figure out, what laws do we need to address circumstances that will be coming up? And you need an immense amount of information to do that. And nobody going into the legislature has that already at their fingertips. And so the oversight authority and responsibility is to go out into the wide world and obtain the information necessary to legislate wisely. And so so what we found out is that there's really nothing out there, no comprehensive guide on how to do this part of the legislature's responsibility, nothing in the country to do that. And so so I was asked to write a groundbreaking manual on legislative oversight for Wisconsin. And I did that, and it was a pleasure doing it. And it became a more and more interesting project as I went further into it. And that's out there now, and it was received well enough that I was then asked to write one for the state of Michigan.
I say you're doing other states
that's
now,
right.
Right?
Yeah, and so I've done that one, and I'm working on one for Illinois now, which is almost done. And then
I feel like I should give you a blessing. Well, Illinois, wow, that's brave. I mean, I've seen how they operate there.
Yeah, I was intrigued to get the invitation to write one for Illinois.
I'm guessing that invitation did not come from Governor Pritzker.
I think that's a fair assumption. So we're just about done with that. And then there are a couple more in the pipeline. And the objective is to have one for each state.
Which, again, literally you should. I mean, I don't mean just you writing them, but it makes sense. You have citizen legislators. I mean, these are guys and gals that are coming from all walks of life.
Yep.
They get like a day or two worth of You know, training, indoctrination, whatever you want to call it. And then they're kind of set free.
Yeah.
And this is not a criticism of them.
No, it's not.
But there should be some kind. I mean, it's like you won't hire somebody and be like, oh, I want you to be the quarterback of our NFL franchise. Here's the football. Good luck.
Yeah. No instructions.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why you have quarterbacks coach, you have offensive coordinators. You have all these things in there to help them. Not they don't have the raw talent, but you've got to develop that talent. And I think there's a wide range of thoughts and beliefs and feelings on 2020 and 2022, but at the same, no matter where you are in the spectrum, those legislators knowing clearly how they can exercise that oversight, I don't think anybody argues that that's not needed. And I hope and pray that the legislature in Wisconsin, certainly these other states, will continue to have you come in to train them on the manual. Because, I mean, you made the manual. Now the next big heavy lift is getting a bunch of politicians to read something. So, that's
a great point about their talent. This is not meant to critique their talent at all.
No.
But, you know, people do come to the legislature from all walks of life. And the skill set to do effective oversight is not something that you would, you know, naturally do if you're, say, a real estate agent or a nurse or a doctor even. These are kind of specialized skill sets, and so they just need a little bit of a guide in how to do it. And so, you know, I started out, there's no way you can keep me from the Constitution when I write something. So I start out with a detailed description of the authority of each of the branches of government and why it's so important that each of the branches exercise their own authority and not the authority that the people have assigned to the other branches. Now, there's no policy discussion in these
manuals. This is purely
just procedure.
The how-to manual.
Exactly. It's how-to. And most of the manual is actually a step-by-step guide on how to do it. So you pick the topic that you want to exercise oversight on, and then you just follow the steps that I've got in the manual, and you will do a very effective job in legislative oversight.
You sound like me on Open Line Fridays. You pick the topic, I'll set the tone. I'll set the tone and the tempo.
Yeah, there
so
you go.
Now let's talk about your time on the court, because obviously you want people to come vote for you.
I do.
They can go to justicedanielkelly.com to learn more, and it's K-E-L-L-Y. There's no, you know, Kelly
just
can
one
be,
E.
Right. Yep. There can be in Daniel, traditional D-A-N-I-E-L, justicedanielkelly.com. I note that in your endorsement, a lot of sheriffs, by the way, great. We have some great, great sheriffs in the state of Wisconsin. Judge Shelley Grogan, who I got to know when she was running, has endorsed you, as has sitting Justice Rebecca Bradley. And now this, by the way, you're looking to replace Patience Rogensack, who's the Chief Justice right now, if I'm not mistaken, on the court.
So it's a
big place to, I mean, as goes the composure of the court. We have a constitutionalist leaving. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure we have a constitutionalist going in, not somebody. Again, the two candidates from the left are very open about, get me in there, baby. They don't even try. It's kind of shocking how blatant they are. You talk about shilling. I mean, hey, you know, what do you want? We'll give it to you. But you were on the court. When you were on the court, you were you dealt with some very big cases, some that we obviously feeling the impact even now. I know Wisconsin legislature versus secretary designee Andrea Palm. This is one that was, again, we go back to the nightmare that was the COVID overreach.
I'm still trying to forget that.
Yeah, it's painful. I mean, but tell us a little bit, if we can. I want to explore, again, not cases coming up, but cases you were a part of. What was that issue, and how did you get to a resolution?
Yeah, so that was a fascinating case from a constitutional perspective. Let me just set the table a little bit. So this had to do with the Safer at Home order.
Oxymoron, but yes, go ahead.
So Secretary Palm one day walked into her office in Madison.
The Berkeley of the Midwest, yes.
And she sat down at her keyboard, and she tapped out a new law. And then she printed off the printer and held it up for all to see and said, behold my law.
Yes, and it is good. She didn't just stop. The arrogance of that also went to the genuflect, because this is good kind of attitude. But yes, good.
So, folks will, and I hesitate to remind them of this because it was a painful time, but it told everyone they had to stay at home unless Secretary Palm said they could leave, shut down businesses unless Secretary Palm said that they were essential, prohibited people from going to church, to synagogue, to mosque. It told students they could not go to school. It was a detailed plan on how to live your life, down to details like how to cough and how to sneeze. And that came to the court for consideration in right quick order. And we looked at that, and we decided that it was an unlawful order. It was a 4-3 decision. Now, that should have been 7-0.
It again, because it's not political. It's a question of individual liberty.
That's right.
And what is the Constitution? And what are the, she has no power to make laws.
No power to make law. That is, as the people of Wisconsin have said, that power belongs to the Assembly and the Senate. And Secretary Palm was in neither of those.
But she is now.
Well,
she is now. Talk about, you know, if you want to know if she did. Now, in, I would think, I don't want to, again, I'll give my opinion. She did a terrible job as the secretary designee. She was a train wreck from the beginning. But now, looking at it from a different point of view, which would be the progressive left, she was a godsend to them. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that she's now in the Biden administration in a very similar role. Just let that ruminate a little to where these policies, you know, what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. And so so the decision of the court was it was an unlawful order because she did not follow the procedure for promulgating a new rule. All right. So fair enough. That's true. She did not follow that procedure, and therefore it was an unlawful base order on that basis alone. But that wasn't the biggest problem. The biggest problem was that she had taken the legislature's authority and used it in the executive branch to make new law. So Justice Rebecca Bradley and I, we wrote separately to address that aspect. Now think about that. So this was a 4-3 decision, but only two justices saw the problem with a violation of the separation of powers.
And under the oversight, the booklet you wrote, what can the legislature do? Is there an oversight that they have? Because there's checks and balances between the branches. Because, I mean, that's a pretty brazen abuse of power to try to seize the power of legislation into the executive branch. I mean, this is where you get banana republic kind of things going on.
Yeah. So this is where the drafters of the Constitution thought that this would be a robust form of government because each of the branches of government would be jealous of their own authority. And so if one of the other branches comes tripping into their turf, the expectation was they would stand up immediately and say, wait just one minute, that's our authority, you back off, you go do your thing, we'll do ours. And so in this kind of a circumstance, it would be appropriate for the legislature to stand up and say, hang on a second, where do you think you got the authority to do that? And we're going to come have you come in and we're going to have a hearing and you're going to explain to us where you think you get the power to make the law. And then and that is important because then the legislature might sit down and go, you know what, we might need a new law to address that, or we might need to change an existing law if we want to protect our own turf, right? So that's the reason you do oversight, is to discover what's happening in the world, how is the executive branch handling the laws that we passed, are they doing it in a way that is consistent with what we had planned when we adopted this law, and if it's not, then you need to come in and answer for it. And then we as a legislature, we can decide, you know, what are we going to do in response to this? Do we change funding levels? Do we adopt a new law?
Because they could effectively eliminate the position by defunding it.
Right,
which they all seem to forget. Now, if we talked a little earlier about the First Amendment, McAdams versus Marquette, was that essentially was a First Amendment case that you were in on as well, correct?
Yeah, so that was a freedom of speech within the context of a private university and their promise of academic freedom. And so there was a contract between Professor McAdams and Marquette University, and it promised academic freedom to the professor. And so what happened is he'd made some blog posts that the administration of the university thought were problematic within the terms of their mission of the school. And so the question became, can the administration suspend him either for a period of time or indefinitely for writing something that the school believed was in derogation of their mission? And so the responsibility of the court there was to look at the contract that he had signed, consider the concept of academic freedom as it was described in the contract and the documents to which the contract referred, and then decide whether the administration's action was consistent with those contractual commands. So that resides within First Amendment considerations. But the specific question we were being asked was, what are the contours of academic freedom in this context? And what we found was that the university had set aside the principles of academic freedom to which they committed themselves by contract, and had indefinitely suspended him.
Because in that case, you can't, your academic freedom can't go one political direction.
That's right.
Can't go one ideological. I mean, I just had this conversation.
If it does, it's not academic freedom.
Right. Well, I was talking in my broadcast show today about this hockey player that didn't want to partake in the pre-warm-ups because it was part of a pride night, and he said it went against his religious beliefs. Well, the sportscaster got really angry and said, well, this isn't inclusive. You're fighting inclusivity. And I said, well, hold on. Wouldn't inclusivity mean that you accept the opinions of those that support this and those that don't support it? Otherwise, you're being exclusive. You're excluding people that you don't agree with, which is, I mean, essentially what we're dealing with, or what you were dealing with in this case of, if you're going to have academic freedom, it's like freedom of speech. I don't, because I can dislike what you're saying, that doesn't mean you can't say it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's, you know, and I think it's important to point out that this was in the context of a private university.
Sure, sure. Right?
And so if they had decided, look, we want professors, but we don't want to extend academic freedom to them. Well, they could do that.
That's in their contract, if they have that contract.
If they have that in the contract, right? So this was a question of, what did you promise to your professors, and did you follow through on that promise? And so, you know, the analysis would be a little different if it was a public university, because the First Amendment applies directly, without intermediation at all, to public universities. And so, but this was the this was a seminal case, because oddly enough, there's just not much out there in the literature, in judicial opinions, on the question of academic freedom. And so it became an opinion that people looked at around the country.
Well, I say that question of academic freedom is again, one post-COVID that's growing at every level, from elementary to college, because people are realizing there's been a lot happening they weren't aware of. Wisconsin Carry versus the city of Madison. Mm-hmm. This was a Second Amendment question.
Yeah, so it was. If you trace it far enough back, you'll hit a constitutional provision. Interestingly enough, this was pretty straightforward question of matching up local regulations and state statutes. So there was a state statute that says municipalities cannot regulate the carrying of firearms more stringently than a state statute, and Madison said, well, we see your statute, and we're going to forbid the carrying of firearms on public transportation. And so the question was, is forbidding the carrying of firearms more stringent than a statute that says you can carry firearms?
Which would seem to be pretty strange.
I thought it was pretty easy decision.
But nonetheless, they fight it. And then, is it Tetra Tech? Is that the right way to say
that?
And again, this is versus the Department of Revenue in Wisconsin, not unlike the Andrea Palm situation, where you have a question of bureaucratic, who actually makes the rules is really what this.
Yeah. So that was, whereas the Palm decision was the executive taking the legislature's authority, Tetra Tech was the executive taking the judiciary's authority.
I'm seeing a theme here when it comes to the executive branch right now in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, and this is, this is not limited to Wisconsin. I mean, this is part of a tendency to collapse power and authority into one place. And so the tendency is to move legislative power to the executive branch, to move judicial power to the executive branch, and just concentrate it all there. But, the framers of our Constitution, the United States Constitution, they looked at the separation, and they said that's the primary protection of our liberties, making sure that all of that power does not get concentrated in one branch of government.
Because that's what the monarchy was.
That's exactly
and
right.
In the case of the monarchy, I mean, again, if you accept what their principle was, The monarch was chosen not by the people, but by God. So how dare you question the monarch? And in the secular sense, a consolidated power in any executive branch in our form of government, whether it's been bastardized or not, I mean, essentially you have a secular monarchy at that point.
Yeah, so the framers of our Constitution, when they were writing about this, they said, look, the courts are going to be the least dangerous branch of government because they have neither force nor will, but only judgment. And even for the execution of that judgment, they're dependent on one of the other branches. So they're going to be, don't you worry about the courts. They're not going to be dangerous at all, right? And that's what Alexander Hamilton wrote. And it's tempting to say, oh, Alexander, if you only knew.
He was a good man, but he had his moments.
If you only knew. Yeah. But you know what? He did know, because he went on to write. And he said, look, it's the least dangerous branch of government as long as it does just the job of the court. Mm-hmm. But if it were to ever combine its power with one of the other branches, that would be the very definition of tyranny. Right, so he knew the danger of combining those, and so our project.
Him saying that now, they'd say he's an insurrectionist.
You never know what they might say about. We'll get to some interesting quotes, I think, from one of my opponents on this very subject. But in the Tetra Tech case, so we were looking at there was, we understand that we have to keep those branches within their own boundaries. That's part of the
stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane. And so what we saw in Tetra Tech was the development over about 100 years of the court's habit of deferring to the executive branch on the interpretation of the law. And so what would happen, people would be litigating against an executive agency. They come to court. And the executive agency would tell the court, well, this is what the law means, and you must defer to me. And the court would go, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll defer to you. And this became so calcified that it became a standard of review in which we'd say, well, you know, how much expertise does the agency have? The more expertise they have, the more we'll defer to what they think the law means. And we looked at it, and we were like,
Nope.
That's the job. That is literally the job of the court to determine the meaning of the law and how that applies to this case. And so we set aside almost 100 years of mistaken cases to get back to what the Constitution says that each of the branches must do.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah. You had mentioned your opponent. I want to get to the. But go ahead. I didn't want to cut you off on that.
So that was that became a seminal case, and that is quoted quite frequently now in cases where an administrative agency is a party to a case, because the first thing you have to do is figure out who decides the law, and we said that's the judiciary.
So and again, I try to. I like to focus on the person I'm speaking with. But one of the big, and this is again nationwide, certainly something we're dealing with in the state of Wisconsin. It was drawn into real clear focus with the Darrell Brooks case, where you had a guy that literally ran over the mother of his child with his car. It was out on the streets. Not even 24 hours later, just a few days later, he was the guy that. Executed the Waukesha Christmas massacre, taking the very same vehicle, purposefully driving through a Christmas parade to kill people, apparently because he's just, that's the kind of guy he is. I mean, I don't know if there was anything deeper than that, but this drew into very clear focus in the state of Wisconsin, the question of cash bail or no cash bail or low cash bail. Sometimes I know when I speak to people publicly about the phraseology confuses people. The basic concept of no cash bail or low cash bail is this idea that the perpetrators of crimes are actually kind of the victims. I mean, it's kind of the mentality. They may not use those words. And therefore, we should make it as easy as possible for them to get back out onto the street so they can wreak more havoc. Again, my interpretation of the progressive mindset. But this is a big question. I'm not asking how you necessarily would handle a case if it came in front of the Supreme Court, but in your career both as a former Supreme Court justice and a commercial litigator and so forth. What has been your take on the question of the value of being able to basically set deterrence to letting criminals back out on the streets where they can do more damage?
Yeah, so this is this goes to a really significant question in the way the court does its work. So what we have is defendants come to court. They've been accused of a crime, and they are presumed innocent until proven guilty, right? So, and that's it's not just a slogan. That is how we approach criminal defendants. But at the same time, we know that there are public safety issues afoot, and the court has to figure out how are we going to conduct our business and protect the community at the same time. Now, right now, our Constitution provides that cash bail can only be used to encourage a criminal defendant to return to court for the next hearing. So you cannot take into account the severity of the crime of which they've been accused, and you cannot take into account the defendant's criminal history. You can only look at what's the likelihood that they're going to show up, and we set cash bail in relation to that. So there's been a debate for a number of years about whether or not we should even have cash bail. And there are those who advocate the complete elimination. And they say, well, if they're presumed innocent, then let's just make sure that we are just, not putting any inhibitions on their ability to rejoin society while their case is pending. And the alternative to that has been, well, look, it's not like criminal defendants don't have any restrictions placed on them prior to trial at all. I mean, there are requirements that they not reoffend. Right. There might be requirements that they not leave the state. There might be requirements that they engage in certain monitoring activities. I mean, so we already are placing some restrictions on their liberty. So the balance is to figure out how do you respect the presumption of innocence while also protecting the community while the court does its work. And so there are those who err on the, if there is an error, they'll err on the side of let's make sure there are as few restrictions as possible. And then those on the other side who say the court doesn't have enough tools in its toolbox to make sure that the community is safe pending the court completing its work in that case. And so there's a proposed constitutional amendment that would allow courts to consider the defendant's criminal history and consider the severity of the crime and the need to protect the community while the court is doing its business. And so my understanding is that is pending in the state legislature for the second consideration, and that if it passes, it will go on to a statewide referendum on the April ballot.
And now, I want to think how I can ask this. Well, first of all, that amendment, is that something you can comment on in terms of your feeling on whether it's a good idea, bad idea? What would your...
Yeah, so I think I can comment on it in broad strokes. And what I would say is it's always good for the court to have more tools rather than fewer in dealing with individual cases so that the court has the maximum ability to ensure that they can do their work and have the community protected at the same time while continuing to respect the presumption of innocence. And so the more tools in their toolbox to do that, I think this is better.
Your opponents in this race, there's four people, only two make it through the primary on February 21st. Two of them are very progressive. They have been pretty vocal in their belief that the no cash bail, the low cash bail, they favor. I mean, again, they don't really pull punches on where they stand. I don't mean that as a compliment either. I mean, it's kind of amazing how, you know, brazenly they'll put some of this out there. They have no problem with this idea that you make it easier to get people back out onto the streets, no matter if it's a consideration of them coming back to court or even if this amendment were to pass and become part. I mean, that's a process that takes quite a while to do. Kind of no matter the rationale, it seems that their default is, nope, let them go.
So this is actually kind of an interesting thing. It's been intriguing to me to watch this over the last couple of months, because I thought that that's where the Dane County Circuit Court judge would be and where the Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge would be. But then just recently there came to light a recording of a legislative hearing in which one of my other opponents was participating, Jennifer Doro, in which she said that she favored the elimination of cash bail. And that became an article that got published. And apparently the reporter asked Everett Mitchell, the Dane County Circuit Court judge, what he thought of that. And Judge Mitchell said, oh, I don't think we should eliminate cash bail. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. And then just recently, Janet Protasiewicz, the Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, came out and said, absolutely not. No elimination of cash bail. I favor the constitutional amendment. And in fact, it doesn't go far enough. And so I was.
And I believe her totally that she really feels that way. It's not that she's running for Supreme Court.
I've not talked with her about it. So I can't judge the value of her sincerity in that. But I did find it interesting that the Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge and the Dane County Circuit Court judge says, yeah, no, we can't eliminate.
Well, and then recently, it was reported that Jennifer, is it, I always say Doro, is it Doro? Is that
Doro?
Doro. I just want to know. She's saying she supports this amendment, which is interesting because, as you said, there's audio of her. I mean, it can't, now people can change their minds, I suppose.
They can.
But there's been no explanation, right? There's not been to my knowledge, a statement where, well, I was young, you know, I thought that then, you know, years, you know, having gone through X number of cases, I mean, I have the statement in front of me. The proposed constitutional amendment aligns with my long-held views and is a step, in the right direction. The change is long overdue. I mean, that legislative hearing wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was 5 years ago.
So, I mean, that seems to be, there's a conflict there. And again, and I'm going to ask her, I mean, I'm interviewing her next week, so I'm going to ask her, you know, for her answer. But I guess as a voter, I mean, these are the things you have to look at. I mean, people can change. Ronald Reagan, he evolved very much to the right, very much to, you know, I mean, he started out as a Democrat, became a Republican, died a conservative. I mean, you know, there's no question. So it can happen, but usually there's an explanation.
Yeah.
I mean, I use Reagan as the example. I mean, I wasn't a judge, but he was very open about the fact, yeah, I did this, you know, and I was wrong, you know, and he'd say, I learned.
Yeah.
When you have a statement saying it's a long-held belief that conflicts with a public statement, it leaves you wanting.
Yeah, so I value, and I think most people do, intellectual consistency.
Yes.
But that does not exclude, as you say, the possibility of change. You know, sometimes we come across new information and we say, oh, well, in light of that, I need, you know, I was apparently wrong and I need to change my position. Or you just go back and you reevaluate what your position was and you go, you know what, I think I have a better understanding now. And so I think there should always be room for people to change their mind. I just think, you know, if you do change your mind, it's probably a good idea to explain why.
Well, again, it's not that hard. I mean, I to your point, I think it to me, it's more valid because then people, I mean, it's the road to Damascus, right? How do you know Saul? I mean,
that's right.
It can happen.
Yeah.
But then that becomes part of the testament, right? I mean, that's part of why.
That's right.
You know, especially if you're, and I don't mean this in a profane way, but you're selling yourself, or you're selling your, why are you the person? Which brings me to the question I want, and I purposely wanted to ask this question at the end of the interview, not the front end, although it's something people usually lead with, you know, why should they vote for you? Part of what I wanted to do in this last, believe it or not, it's been an hour we've been talking at this point, which I don't, I mean, again, you and I, we talk on the phone probably for this long time too, because you have some amazing wisdom that I just love to be able to share it with the audience. Part of what I was trying to do with this, and it's why I talked about your past, talked about these cases, is I wanted them to know who you were before I asked the question, which is, on February 21st, why should you be the top person that they pick for Supreme Court justice? I mean, yes, you had private litigation experience. You've lived you've lived that life. You've been consistent in it. You've been on the court, but they've got to make a decision about who's the best. I mean, get the, I guess two people make it through, but ultimately, I look at who's the number one choice. Who do we want to see on the Supreme Court in August when the swearing-in takes place? Why are you that person?
Well, I really appreciate you asking the question. I mean, we could spend the rest of the afternoon chatting.
Easy.
I love this. But I look at it this way. So over the last year and a half, I've been traveling around the state of Wisconsin and talking to a lot of folks about the future of their court and the future of their state. And one of the things I hear with regularity is that they don't want to gamble on who the next Supreme Court justice is going to be. They want to know, have you done this? Have you demonstrated a facility in dealing with constitutional issues? Have you demonstrated that you are faithful to the original public meaning of the Constitution? And can you bring that to the work of the Supreme Court and do it effectively there in dealing with the other members of the court in the opinions that are written? And they say, we don't want to risk this. And so, and after they tell that, they say that, and they say, we want you to run again. And so that has played heavily into my decision. And I think that when they say that they want me to run again, they're looking at that public proven record of constitutional conservatism. And so that looks something like this. So I was a known constitutional conservative for a long, long time before I was appointed to the Supreme Court. So in addition to my private practice, I spent my free time helping lead the Federalist Society, an educational organization whose primary goal is to help people understand, promote, and apply the original public meaning of our Constitution. And so it was an honor and a privilege to do that all over the state. And so that's a part of that proven record of being a constitutional conservative. And then, of course, there's the work that I did on the court. So the seminal cases that I've written that deal with constitutional issues. And then my whole body of work has been cited, quoted, or relied upon hundreds of times by courts here in Wisconsin and across the country. And then off the court, I've given over 100 lectures all over the state on the nature and proper role and function of a court within a constitutional framework. And in addition, we've talked about this a little bit already. I've written extensively about these kinds of issues, including the legislative oversight manuals, in which I detail each of the types of authority delegated to each of the branches of government, why it's important that each of them remain faithful to what the Constitution says. And then, I guess, just to wrap it up, you know, we have two premier constitutional conservatives in our judiciary today. And they are Justice Rebecca Bradley on the Supreme Court and Judge Shelley Grogan on the Court of Appeals. And both of them have endorsed me. But I think the reason that they endorsed me is important. They looked at each of the four candidates in this race, and their conclusion after that examination was that I am the only constitutional conservative in this race. And I think that's why I've had people ask me to run all over the state. And I would like to ask your listeners that if they agree that it is essential and imperative that we have a constitutional conservative on the court, I ask that they would support me and that they would vote for me. But here's the thing. This is their seat. It belongs to them. And it is entirely up to them to exercise their wisdom and their judgment on who they want sitting in that seat. And so my bottom line request is that they look carefully at each of the four candidates and then make a good and reasoned decision on who they promote to that seat. And I will be happy to abide by whatever that decision is. Now, I hope they decide to support sure. me. But it, as a matter of respect for the people of Wisconsin, my commitment is whatever their decision is, that is theirs to decide, and I will absolutely respect that.
To learn more, go to Justice Daniel Kelly, all spelled out, JusticeDanielKelly.com. You can learn more. You can read about some of the work he did, learn more about Justice Kelly. And as well, you can donate. You can volunteer. You can put signs in your yard. And did I mention you can donate? We always people running for office, they never want to. But look, the fact of the matter is, it takes money to run a campaign. There's staffers, there's media buys, there's all these things. It's up to us if we want the right people to give our time, our talent, and our treasure, whatever in whatever combination we can. And you can do that at JusticeDanielKelly.com. Now we will have you back. Because there's a question I didn't even get to that's on the list, but I wanted. But
wonderful.
One more before we hit the road.
Yeah.
Now, I think the last time we spoke, I don't remember if I asked you the great cookie debate or not. I think I did ask you about that the last time. Don't worry. It's not going to be not a cookie debate today. But this is a, you know, they say to peel back the curtain, or in this case, perhaps the robe, the judicial robe.
Yes.
One of the things about the state Supreme Court and the Supreme Court of the United States, you hear, you know, the court is in session in September and they hear things in November, and then they give their decisions in June. A lot of people have theories of what's going on in all of that time. Now, I'm sure you've seen the memes, you know, what people think I do, what my family thinks I do, what I really do. Under that kind of an auspice, I know that the presentation of the court is that there's a lot of deep thought, research, discussion, debate, jurisprudence going on behind the scenes. But there's also a theory that when no one else is around, there are no robes. There's no moments of straight, important thought. But there's really like partying going on. There's like there's a secret hidden pool that might be going on. What's really going on? As someone that's been on the court, we the people have a right to know what's really going on in all that time period that lapses between when you open the courts, when you hear the case, and when the decisions come down.
Yeah, we go to Hawaii.
If you're going to go big, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely, you know. Absolutely. You know, if there is, if there were member only parties, nobody invited me, and I might be
picked at the scab on the wound there.
Yeah, I'm going to be a little sore now.
Well, I think you should call Justice Bradley and see what's going on.
I think I'm going to have to do that.
So there's no toga parties, there's no pool parties. There's no like frat type mentality.
None that I'm aware of.
All right, so one in the justices' lunchroom, is there really a tap there or not? We had a very serious conversation for an hour. I had to make sure we broke the tension a little the end. So what you're telling me is what you see is what you get.
What you see is what you get. The job takes an enormous amount of time, and so I thought that when I was litigating at one of the top law firms in the country, that was a time-intensive job. Nothing compared to the work of the court. So I would.
So you're open to the toga parties
I'm
or the pool parties?
I'm open
just
to
as a,
it.
Just
yes.
as a way of getting.
Yes,
that
I am. Now you know we want to make sure that we protect taxpayer dollars.
Right. I was assuming
if there's some kind of party that we can be a part of, that would be wonderful. Fun.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of money in the UW fund. Just, anyway, I'll stop now. Justice Daniel Kelly, I appreciate you joining us again. You want to learn more? JusticeDanielKelly.com. I appreciate you joining us today on the VIP Backstage Soundcheck podcast. We will have you back again soon. As a matter of fact, I have something in mind in about a week that I think we should talk about. Perhaps we'll have you on the show for a little bit as well. As always, I learn so much when we get together. I think you acquit yourself well as somebody that takes this seriously, understands the Constitution, and more importantly, understands the role of a Supreme Court justice. I think you've given people a lot to think about today.
Well, Joe, you're most kind, and you know that I love being on your show and on your podcast. So thank you very much. This has been great.
Pleasure's been all mine. Well, that's what you have with it today on the VIP Backstage Soundcheck podcast. You want to learn more? Go to JusticeDanielKelly.com. We've talked about it many times before. We talked about it just now with the justice. It's all about we the people. We're the sovereigns. We got to do the work. We got to do the research. We got to find out who's running, why they're running, and who is worthy of our support. You just got an hour-plus job interview with Justice Daniel Kelly. Now it's up to you to do the rest of that research and make the wise decision. As I leave you today, I give you those three words we end each and every time together that we spend, and those words that no matter where your path may go, no matter what the question may be, it will get you to the right answer. Live life boldly. See you soon.